You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. And this is a really special one because it is the starting episode of a little series of a couple of episodes that I'm doing together with the HTA Special Interest Group. I'm really happy to have Lara and Anders here today to speak about this. And let's first a little bit of an introduction. Lara, do you want to start?
My name's Lara Wolfson, and I work for MSD based in Zurich, Switzerland. I lead the HTA Statistics Group at MSD, a group of about 80 dedicated statisticians who work with an equal number of programmers, specifically to reanalyze clinical data for health technology assessment submissions. I've been in this role for about 4 years. I have a PhD in statistics from Carnegie Mellon University in the US, but I'm actually Canadian. And I've been working in the pharma industry for about 10 years. Prior to that, I spent 10 years with the World Health Organization and also time in academic positions in the US and Canada.
Very good. 80 statisticians, dedicated statisticians, that is by far the biggest number that I've ever heard. And of course, MSD is not a small company. So that a little bit into perspective, is that probably other companies that have less than 80 statisticians overall, but that's quite significant department. Okay, Anders, what about you?
I'm part of the HTA SIC and I'm working as an HTA statistician within Novo Nordisk based in Copenhagen, Denmark. We're part of a smaller group. I think we're about 5 people now working within HTA statistics. And it's something that I think my group was established soon be 2 years ago. And to my background, I've been within pharma for 7 years. And actually, before I started working more dedicated within HTA, I was working as a regulatory statistician. So I had 5 years of experience also working with that. And before that, I was actually working somewhere completely different, which was more academia within pharmacoepidemiology. So a bit of exposure also to real world evidence. And I have a PhD from university here in Denmark.
Cool. Very good. Yeah, it's actually quite helpful to have this mixed background in terms of both HTA and clinical. And yes, this episode will actually speak quite a lot about this. So let's talk about European HTA, EU HTA, because there's a couple of really significant changes going on that have started some time ago. And yeah, Lara, do you want to give a little bit of a high-level intro in terms of what's happening here at the moment?
So I think here it's helpful to take a step back and say what's going on with health technology assessment itself. One of the challenges we're facing in our world is that there's all these fantastic new medicines and vaccines that pharma companies are developing and bringing to bear. Health systems have challenges in saying, how do we choose between them? How do we afford them? And so they've started making this more and more formal as there's more and more options on the table. And So regulatory approval, which is where we start in the pharma world, says, is this product safe and effective? Is it suitable for use in humans compared to, there's other options on there. Is it at least as safe and as effective as everything else out there? In HTA, we're asking a different question. We're trying to use the same data. How good is it? And that's a different question. And so we actually need to look at the data in a different way. More and more countries around the world have started saying, how are we going to interrogate the data to ask these questions? And not just interrogate the clinical data, but you've got your regulatory or pivotal trial that you've used to get regulatory approval. What other sources of data do they need to bring into the picture? How do we decide if this is worth paying for, how much it's worth paying for? You start to look at things like, are there particular subgroups or subpopulations who benefit more than others? How do you financially value some of the trade-offs between some of the side effects? With health technology assessment, we're asking a different question than we ask in the regulatory context. Not just, is it safe and effective? How safe? How effective? Is it? How does it compare to the other alternatives we have? Can we quantify that? Can we add some economic dimension so that we can determine how much we're willing as a society to pay for it? And are there particular subpopulations who benefit from a new treatment more than others or less than others? And so we start to segment it a lot more. And sometimes as statisticians, we talk about over-interrogating it because we design these studies to get medicines to patients as fast as possible. We think there's a new treatment that could benefit people. So we design a regulatory trial to demonstrate that it's safe and effective, get that regulatory approval and make it available to patients. But then on the health technology assessment side, we're taking it apart in a different way. And maybe we're bringing in alternative sources of data, real world evidence, data from other trials where we might have to do indirect treatment comparison, but putting it all together to answer questions. And then this becomes very contextual. In the European context, we have the European Medicines Agency, which does a pan-European regulatory approval. Most of the countries in Europe have developed their own processes to evaluate whether this medicine should be reimbursed and at what level it should be reimbursed at. And that has to be contextualized in terms of what they've approved before. You're looking at the standard of care and you're saying, how does this compare to the other treatments that are available? And so maybe there's a treatment where there's a guideline, for example, that says if you're under 75 years of age, this is not your first route of treatment. But if you're over 75, it is now the data has to be analyzed that way because we have to look at how does it perform in over 75 versus under 75. And this varies across Europe. It could be that in one country, that split is at 75. In another country, that split is at 65. And so you have 27 member states in the European Union. Each of them has their own standards of care. Different medicines are reimbursed in different countries, and they've all evolved different rules and regulations. This has been evolving quite intensely for the last 20 years. At the European level, they've been discussing, does this make complete sense? Do we want it this way? Is it fair that just because you live 100 miles apart across or 100 kilometers apart across a border, one person can get access to a medicine and another person can't? There's a question of, could we make this simpler as well? There's also huge delays in timing of access. You'll find that there's some markets where as soon as there's a regulatory approval, for example, in Germany, they have a process that says as soon as that opinion comes out from the European Medicines Agency, they're immediately going into discussions. That medicine is immediately available. And a year later, a price is set because of the HTA process. Other countries have a process where the timing is not as close to regulatory approval and it can take a few years. And so there's been lots of discussions. Can you harmonize the processes across Europe? Can you speed up access so that there's equality of access in timing across Europe? And so there's been these voluntary cooperations that people have tried to experiment with. And there's been this series of different joint actions sponsored by the European Commission. We hear them talked about as UNETA. But in December 2021, they actually passed a regulation that said starting in 2025, we are going to have a common EU-HTA assessment. And it will form the basis of the country assessments that will follow. Each country has its own standards of care, its own reimbursement pathways, different ability and willingness to pay in different countries. So there's still going to be a national HTA process, but at least starting from a common foundation. It's interesting watching the evolution of this and the amount of data reanalysis of the clinical data has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. There's also a lot of economic modeling, and the economic modeling part of this will still sit at the country level. That won't be part of the joint assessment. They did pass this regulation in December 2021. Over the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to be shaping how this regulation takes shape, exactly what analyses need to be done, how are they going to do the joint clinical evaluations, starting in 2025, at first with novel cancer molecules and ATMP products. It's going to start. It'll take 5 years to fully take effect to cover all medicinal products and vaccines. By 2030, there's going to be a joint clinical assessment that feeds into the subsequent national assessments. And it's a huge undertaking, but lots of opportunities, particularly in the next 18 months, to say, what's the right statistical way to do this? Challenge is today, we don't design the trials to meet HTA needs. And if you think about the pathways of clinical development, the trials that are already in progress that will start to read out in 2025, those trials have already been designed, have first patients enrolled. But there's going to be a lot of questions that come up later in the game, which is that now that we know this process is going to be taking place, will it change the way we design some of those trials? So as statisticians, there's all these different dimensions of how you want to get involved. One is, what's the advice we can give about how they shape what should be in the joint clinical assessment? How are we going to build capacity to do this type of assessment, not only within pharmaceutical companies, but all the assessors who have to be involved? The assessors are going to come from the national agencies and then work together at the EU level. I don't think there's enough of them. This is something we've talked a lot about, this capacity issue, and how do you develop it overall? I think it's an interesting challenge because there's going to be this huge emphasis on statistical analysis of clinical data, reanalysis that the studies weren't designed for. Do we actually have enough statisticians in Europe?
In the different companies, we have just seen that there's a huge discrepancy between the different companies like Roche and Novartis and Pfizer. They have all different organizations. Some have local people, some have regional, some have global people. It's very diverse. Some people don't even report in the same organizations. They report into R&D, sometimes they report into commercial, sometimes they report into affiliates. There's all kind of different things going on. And that doesn't make it easier. The number is one thing, the cumulative complexity of the organizations themselves is another hurdle. And as in terms of capacity, that is one thing. And timing is yet another thing. As Laura just mentioned, timing will change as well. How will it change?
So one of the things that will happen here is that the way it's laid out in the regulation is that we will process that PEG to the EMA timelines. So basically what will happen is that once you do your submission to EMA for a new medicinal product, you will also supply the coordination group of EUHGA, and they will set up this process of going out and asking the member countries via questionnaire, okay, what are the things that is interesting for you from perspective of your healthcare system? What kind of population would you be interested in? That might vary between countries. Exactly what does the intervention look like? Are you adding this on top of some kind of background therapy that we should be aware of? What would be the relevant comparators? Again, as I think you're also alluding to, Lara, that might again be different between different countries. What kind of outcomes are you interested in? You might have countries that are more interested in hard clinical outcomes. You might have some that can make do, for example, with surrogate type outcomes. All of this will be pulled together within this information group with the assessors and the co-assessors that will be appointed to overseeing this. And then the member countries will send this information back, and you, as a health technology developer, at some point, I think it's around when we receive 120-day and from EMA, you receive the scope with information about what is relevant to look at here. And of course, there's a concern that has been discussed quite a lot. Will we see 27 different questions that we need to address as technology developers? UNATA 21 is trying to reassure us that this is not how it will happen. But I think irrespective of how things, we'll probably get more than just one question. And it's then up to us to be able to predict that, you could say also well in advance, because we will not have a lot of time. Then we need to go into production mode and have the dossier ready for submission, collating all these different analyses, both based on clinical trials, and maybe we need to do network meta-analysis, maybe we need to do real-world evidence registry studies. And we need to have all that ready for submission no later than 45 days before CHMP opinion. And if you do the math, that's about a 9-week duration that have to prepare. It's quite intense in terms of putting all this together. An important fact here to bear in mind is that it could also be quite the challenge for the people that will then subsequently do the assistant of the dossier that we're providing. Just basically with breadth of evidence that we might include data from clinical trials, it'll be NMAs, be real world studies, there'll also be a lot of pressure on the people that will do the assessment afterwards, because all of this needs to be done. I think it's said 30 days post marketing authorization in Europe where the final joint clinical assessment report needs to be done. So there's also a lot of pressure on the assessors and the co-assessors and the statisticians that will be sitting the other end of the table, actually looking through this and assessing the evidence that we've submitted as health technology developers. So I think this really calls for statisticians also, not just a lot of statisticians, but I think also for statisticians, also those working in the regulatory space, to have increased their understanding also of the HTA mindset and the way that you need to approach evidence when you think in terms of HTA, which I think is different, as Lara also explained, than what you do from a regulatory perspective.
Yeah, and it will mean you need to work very closely together. This is what I've seen across lots of different companies. We first take care of the regulatory submission, and then you get access to the other data.
So the dilemmas here, there's a funny story. One of my first encounters with health technology assessment was when I worked at the World Health Organization. I worked primarily in the vaccines area. And there were some questions about that. We worked a lot with Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations. And Gavi was basically functioning a little bit as a health technology assessment agency because they were making decisions about how were they going to allocate billions of dollars? Which vaccines were they going to give it to? Were they going to give it to measles control? Were they going to use it to support novel vaccines for pneumococcal and rotavirus vaccines? And this is one of the big challenges of health technology assessment, is that on the surface, it seems really simple. It's, oh, we want to fund the most cost-effective intervention. But it turns out a lot of other values come into it. One of the funny things when I did this work with Gavi was that we started reanalyzing all kinds of data. It wasn't so much focused on the clinical data because the effectiveness of these different vaccines was well understood. But the question then became linking it to how many patients were you targeting? And in this case, you weren't targeting people who had a disease, right? Vaccines are preventative. So what was the potential number of kids that you could vaccinate? It's the number of kids that are being born each year. How likely were they to get the disease and potentially suffer severe consequences? And so you started mapping all of this out. What's the morbidity? What's the mortality outcomes? Which outcomes are most important? And then you start to bring in some things that aren't obvious, because it also had to do with, wait a minute, measles vaccines, they've been around for 40, 50 years, right? They're not novel. They're being produced. You don't need to incentivize that. But at this time, it was 2004, 2005, rotavirus and pneumococcal vaccines were just coming into play. And there were other values that came into play, like wanting diversity of supply, wanting to encourage manufacturers. One of the things you saw was that the people who were making the decisions thought they knew what they wanted, what information they wanted. And so they gave us these table shells and said, do all of these analyses, fill these all out. And I started working on them and putting them together. And I kept thinking, how on earth is anyone going to be able to make sense of this? Because 1,000 pages of tables, like who can process that kind of information? And then you produce it all and you start to systematically evaluate it. And it kept pointing to invest in measles control. And everyone kept resisting it because they'd already made up their mind. They really wanted to make sure they were allocating money to rotavirus and pneumococcal vaccines, because one of the core values was stimulating production of new vaccines. This was a global context, not a country-specific context. They wanted to make sure they brought developing country manufacturers in and created incentives for them. But the analyses they asked for were never designed to answer the question. And so this takes it back to one of the critical things about statisticians really starting to understand the health technology assessment system you're working in. It turned out they fundamentally had a utility function that they weren't expressing. And so HTA, whether it's going to be European HTA or the country-specific HTAs, a lot of it is about articulating or interrogating that utility function. What is it that you're really trying to assess and how are you defining value? In the regulatory context, we have a utility function that is implicitly well understood. In the HTA context, I think that utility function is going to continue to evolve. And we're going to have to work with the national HTA agencies and with the European HTA agencies to understand the information that really helps them make their decision. But their challenge also is that they haven't fully articulated a utility function. And so they go after everything. We're likely to see a system that's very similar to the AMNOG system in Germany. People are still submitting them as PDF files. And if you actually printed them, which I'm sure some people are doing, worry about the environmental impact of that.
You need to cut some trees for that.
I have been involved in AMNOG dossiers that run to thousands of pages. And again, I struggle with how do you really make sense of this much information and what information is actually driving the final decisions? And over time, can we work with these systems to focus the analyses they need on what really impacts their decisions? Because I think right now, these HTA systems have a challenge that they know there's all these different aspects they want to go after. So they just ask for everything.
Yep. And all subgroups versus all endpoints versus all time points versus all analysis methodologies by study and combined study and everything. Then you end up easily with, yeah, as you said, thousands and thousands of tables.
And how cognitively, how do you process that? How do you say, how did I get to a decision? How am I sure that my decision is reproducible and traceable and people can understand it? And so on the one hand, as statisticians, we're going to have to meet the needs of these systems. But then there's this other question, which is how can we help to make these systems better and more effective and really understand what they're trying to get at?
That's a really good point. And the HTASIC has really started to get involved there. Yeah. You want to talk a little bit about what you have done already there and what's currently going on there in terms of how the HTASIC helps there?
Yeah, so I just want, before we go on to that, I think I want to also add a comment to what Lara was speaking about, namely this idea that we have this utility function lying around in the different member states that they're not always very explicit about. And basically, I think as you also started out, Lara, this is really about assessing the value of new treatments. And I think in that respect, it's also a massive undertaking what is going on with the UHTA, right? Because the regulation is quite specific that the joint clinical assessments, the dossier that will be producing, the actual assessment that will come afterwards is not something that will in any way dictate how the value should be looked at out in the individual member. That will be up to the member states themselves also, because that will be very much dependent on how the health system is set up. So basically what is lined up now is that you need to produce an assessment broad enough to fit into the value perception of all the different member states. It should be fully objective only about the validity and then put the value assessment out with the member states. I think it will be interesting to see how this actually goes on in practice. I think it also very much easily can end up in a situation where it becomes quite a bit of information overload, right? Because there are so many different perspectives on this. I think this aspect of trying to make a clean cut between value and validity, it's really difficult. I think we also see it in terms of what we see some of the draft methodological guidelines coming out now. When are you making a value judgment? When is it just a case of validity? I think that's also a place where statisticians have something to say. In terms of what's going on in the HTA, so you can say what's happening right now in the preparatory phase leading up to the implementation of the HTA regulations. So until 2025, there's agreement of the tender agreement with the involvement of the UNETA that Lara was alluding to at the beginning, but we have this UNETA 21 consortium that's basically looking into doing even more preparations and making sure that we're in good shape for actually being able to implement the regulation from 2025. And one of the things that they've been doing is drafting extensive methodological guidelines for how the processes should look, what kind of, if you do, for example, a network rats analysis, what are methods for doing that? What should the sentences look for when they get through the dossier? If you do a registry study, what should they look for and so forth? So we've actually been quite busy over the last couple of months. I think United's 21 consortium has been even busier. There's been commenting going on, so public consultations, basically, where there's been input also from industry organizations. We've also commented within the HTA sector. Apart from that, we're also doing things like, for example, participating on your podcast, Alexander, but we're also looking into various other venues of really getting some engagement also within the statistician community and also making people that are not necessarily deeply involved in HTA statistics realize that this is something that will also affect them, that this is really about being able to end up with faster patient access. We really need to think about how do we integrate the HTA perspective also into our pivotal trials so that we're not, when we get at around the same time as the EMA 120-day questions, we get the scope that we're not completely surprised by what we see is to a certain extent predictable.
Yeah, I noticed that, for example, at PSI conference in 2022, there was this lunch meeting where there were lots of different people sitting together and talking about this topic. Yeah, I can absolutely encourage people, check out the HTA Special Interest Group homepage. Check out, if you're a PSI member, there's a newsletter that is coming out. There's also for SPI, there's very often things coming out. Watch out for that. If your company is not yet involved, make sure someone that is involved there. If you don't know who is in your company as a statistician involved, reach out to them. That will be really important. For if you work on phase 2, phase 3, absolutely important. Yeah, really critical. If you're surprised by what you'll get, then it's too late. You should be a high level understanding of these will be the critical points. If then, oh, here's another age cut point, like Lara mentioned, or here's another kind of co-medication to take into account. If you can't cut your data because you haven't collected these covariates, then you're in trouble. Then maybe millions or billions of dollars that your company has invested, it's at risk. So really an absolutely important point. And as I said, this is just the first of a series of episodes with this one. We're not recording them in sequential order, so I can already tell you those will be really good. So really still, no look out for them. Lara, Anders, any kind of final points you want to make and the key takeaways for the listener?
Following on what you said, if you go to our SIG webpage, you'll see that there's the schedule of all these deliverables that the UNETA 21 consortium is producing. These are the first drafts. They're not just first drafts. These are the guidelines that they're going to use for the assessments they do in 2023 and 2024. They're the foundation of what they call the implementing edits of the EU HTA regulation. And so they'll be coming back next year. And in 2024 for finalization, we post the links to the deliverables as well as coordinating input across all these companies on the deliverables. One other angle that you'll have available to you within your company is that most pharmaceutical companies are participating in EFPIA, the European Federation of Pharmaceutical Companies and Industry. We work closely with EFPIA. We provide input to them. We look at, are there statistical issues that we need to particularly emphasize in our feedback to the consortium? This process is going on for the next 3 years. It's incredibly important to understand it, to shape it, to bring it back into your own company in terms of how you're thinking about the design of your trials and looking at all these different dimensions. One thing we didn't talk that much about, but quality of life measures, we collect them in our studies. We summarize them in our regulatory dossiers. They play a huge role in HTA assessments. They come in much more there. Now there's going to be this European level scrutiny. And one thing to also realize about EU HTA and one of the reasons you want to get involved and think about it, even if you're a regulatory statistician, is that the EU HTA assessments are most likely going to be in the public domain. So a lot more of the data and the way that you're going to have to take it apart is going to become much more transparent over the next 5 to 10 years. And so again, thinking about what does that mean for the design of your trials? What does it mean for your choices, methods, and analysis? So one thing I want to give a brief plug for is that on November 14th of 2022, we're going to have a webinar with a panel discussion with some of the people who are the architects of the EUHTA system and talk about some of the statistical issues and ways for the statistical community to get more involved. How do we contribute? How do we upskill ourselves? How do we upskill within our companies? How do we contribute to the bank of knowledge among the assessors? And where are the methodological gaps? Because there are some. There are places where there's no clean-cut answer. It's a great opportunity. It's going to bring some of the statistical issues to the forefront. In our conversation today, we focused a lot about the joint clinical assessment. There's also going to be joint scientific consultations where you can get input on the HTA aspects of the design. It is incredible to see how much of this European HTA system is founded in statistical analysis and principles. Huge opportunity for statisticians to be involved in shaping the future of the healthcare system in Europe. We're really looking forward to getting more and more people involved, more smart people that think about this and contribute to this. The more successful the overall system will be. And I think we all want to see a successful European healthcare system.
Yeah, as you point out, lots of other countries are looking into this. As we have seen with kind of NICE and how it has impacted globally how HTA is done, pretty sure that lots of other countries around the world, including, will have a look into this. Who said might sound, oh, that's Europe. Don't think that way.
Completely agree.
Yeah. Anders, how about you? What are your key takeaways for the listener?
Yeah, I can only echo Lara's call for involvement. I think a bit of confusion also around what can we do. Is it now that the methodological guidelines are being developed, once they're done and finalized from a UNEFSA 21 perspective, does that mean it's set in stone? I think the answer to that question is probably not. At some point, there will be implementing parts of this. And it's in discussion that once the coordination group gets to work, a coordination group of EUHTA will comprise all of the 27 different member countries, a very large representation of some of the German institutions. But once the coordination group gets into work, I think things will also continue to evolve. We will have the implementation starting in 2025, but come 2028, there'll also be a review of, okay, has it actually worked? Does it help out in the individual countries? I think it's not just, okay, it's 2022 and then everything is on and over with and then we just wait for the implementation. I think there's actually also a longer window of opportunity where we can raise engagement and where statisticians can really raise their voice in terms of making sure that we have a good system and importantly, we ensure faster access for patients to new treatments in Europe.
Yeah, completely agree. If you think about NICE, or if you think about GBA and eQuick, they have continually evolved their guidelines. I don't know. In Germany, I think we are now at methods paper number 6. If you look into the NICE technical summary documents, they have grown and evolved. There's lots of different versions of these. So I don't think this will be done and finished. When people see how that actually implements and how these dossiers look and feel and the volume of them, I'm pretty sure that will evolve. People will see, maybe we underestimated the complexity or we underestimated how much pressure that will put into the system. And as Lara mentioned, maybe we underestimated how many statisticians we actually need for it. I think there will be a lot of learning, both on the HTA, the EMA side, and the company side. I also think that other parties, patient advocacy groups, will get more involved because they will potentially drive these kind of utility functions that you mentioned with saying, oh, for us, this endpoint is much better.
I think you're touching on a very important point. Will it just be a massive PDF file with lots of super complex statistics? It'll be super transparent. That's also something built into the HTA regulation. We need to think hard about as statisticians. How do we make this with super complex statistics? It's not accessible in any way for anyone without a PhD degree in statistics. Is that being transparent? Just connect that into 50,000 pages of analysis. I think there's also an opportunity here to think a bit about how do we actually succeed with transparency? Because transparency is not necessarily just putting a lot of stuff out there. It's also thinking carefully about the presentation.
Yeah, completely agree.
I think the transparency initiatives are great, but then I put myself in the position of a cancer patient. I'm diagnosed and I start Googling things and it takes me to this HTA assessment. filled with hundreds of pages of PDF tables. What happens if I get confused about whether or not the treatment my physician is recommending is actually right for me? That's also something we have to think about. How do we make this information digestible to different?
Completely agree. That is so much of an important area. We need to learn not to just speak to other experts, but to treating physicians, patients, parents, or the kids of the patients, because they might take care of their grandparents or parents that are really old and have dementia. So all these things really play a role. Thanks so much. That was an outstanding discussion. And it's such an important point. Head over to the HDA Special Interest Group on the PSI homepage at psiweb.org and find all the other things. And also show notes, the blog here on theeffectivestatistician.com. Check that out as well. Thanks so much, Anders, Lara. Have a great time. And it was an honor to have you on the show.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.